You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. I'm your host, Brent Thomas, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here and to be doing the show for you, all of you out there. It's a great night. This is a really, really cool night for me. Tonight's guest, ladies and gentlemen, is he's one of those guys that I couldn't believe we got him on our show. And that's not me putting our show down. That's just me telling you how incredible I think this guy is. Joining us tonight, of course, is Mr. Donald Schmidt, who is, if you're not familiar with him, then you definitely have to look into what this gentleman has accomplished in his life. He is a best-selling investigative author, lecturer, producer, and illustrator, co-author to Witness to Roswell, former special investigator for Dr. J. Allen Hynek, former co-director, J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, former director of special investigation for CUFOS, and a former Wisconsin State Director of MUFON. He's written a prolific number of books, all of which I think have been on the Amazon bestseller list. His current book, just out, is UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. Mr. Donald Schmidt, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me back, Brent. We had a great time the last encounter, and so I look forward to this one as well.
As do I. Now, I got to say, the last time you were on, you really blew our doors off, and I mean that in a wonderful way. It was just the detail of the information, the background, the granular nature in which you have investigated the Roswell incident. I guess first and foremost, I think your inquiry into that has been ongoing for a number of years. Is there any new developments in all of that?
Well, sadly, as the World War II generation is just about all gone, we are left now to track down the surviving families. And we're finding that for first hand witnesses that we have missed, that now the families are corroborating, are acknowledging what their fathers, what their mothers, what their spouses said just prior to passing on.
Wow.
And it continues to be just unanimous that it was indeed a craft of unknown origin that crashed north of Roswell in 1947. Mm-hmm. There were bodies recovered of an earthly nature. There were attempts to reverse engineer the technology as advanced as it was. And I sit here this evening and tell you that there were little, if any, breakthroughs on that advanced technology. And the linchpin still remains after 72 years. On Tuesday, July 8th of 1947, the United States Army Air Corps, a branch of the United States military, put out an official press release where they announced to the world they had captured a flying saucer. Mm-hmm. And the point being, they started it. They made such a pronouncement. Mm-hmm. And so all I tried to do, and at first, as I was a skeptic, I tried to disprove that. I tried to come up with an alternative, prosaic explanation that still would fit the MO mm-hmm. of all the witnesses involved. And here we are now 72 years later. I can honestly tell you, Brent, I'm 99% convinced that it was that press release which was the correct announcement. Mm-hmm. I can't mm-hmm. emphasize enough. They started it.
Yes.
And I'm going to finish it.
Yeah. Wow. It's got to be a mountain to climb, though, Donald. It's just got to be amazingly daunting to, you know, be butting against an official narrative on a government level. I mean, that's a hell of a task.
Of course. Yeah. And especially in their case with unlimited funding, mm-hmm. unlimited personnel. We were successful in tracking down firsthand witnesses. And I listened to some absolute worthless commodity who's been to New Mexico all of one time, and he solved the case overnight. Never spoke to a single eyewitness. And they're the same ones that, and as we have witnessed the whole impeachment inquiry these past 2 weeks.
Sure.
And they're, no matter what your party affiliation, no matter what your politics, the idea that here they were honing in and trying to build a case on second and third and fourth hand testimony,
yeah,
as though it was all relevant. But then when it comes to Roswell, they go, well, no. You don't have enough firsthand witnesses. In fact, we disqualify all your firsthand witnesses, and you only have second and third hand witnesses. Mm-hmm. And it's like, sir, you don't come into my house and then rearrange my furniture.
Right.
Because you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. And you're insulting your audience because you're deceiving them. You're putting out false information about something as monumental as the visitation and the crash of a craft manufactured off the planet. And you're denying all the witnesses you don't like. Mm-hmm. You're saying they're disqualified. They don't count because they're saying something that you would rather continue covering up, hiding from the public. I would question then, who are you working for? What useful idiot, you know, winds you up and you occasionally come out from underneath your rock and you spew such nonsense?
Yeah.
And then we listen to the news over the last 2 weeks. And we hear that, well, secondhand testimony is sufficient if it corroborates first. And third is also just as good if it corroborates first. And fourth as well. Mm-hmm. And these are all attorneys. So, sorry, you're disqualifying yourself before you even get on the playing field. Because to do that, you have to dishonor all of our firsthand.
Yes.
And sorry, we have over 130 firsthand to the events that happened back in 1947, from 5-year-old children all the way up to 2-star generals. Mm. And they all behaved, they all reacted the same way, as though this was something extraordinary.
Wow. So now, additionally, you are still actively researching the area where all this took place. It's not just an academic search for you.
Of course. In fact, what I find interesting, we're planning on having another archaeological dig. And there are new owners of the respective ranch. And I don't know by whose, you know, sense of values, the fact that there are landmarks out on that very ranch, things that are historical, that were connected, that were involved back at the time of the 1947 incident. And one was the one-room shack that the ranch foreman back at that time, Mac Brazel, W.W. Brazel, when he led the two intelligence officers from the Roswell Army Airfield, as instructed by the very base commander, Colonel William Blanchard. And Brazel would lead counterintelligence officer, Captain Sheridan Cabot, as well as the lead intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group. This was the first atomic bomb squadron in the world. And by the time they arrived at the ranch, it was dusk, late Sunday evening, July 6th. So they spent the night in that one-room shack. Mm-hmm. Well, the new owners, after now 72 years, they have torn that down. It's gone. Oh. An historic landmark. And the well, pump site number one, that is also mentioned throughout the press accounts, that the rancher complained, Brazel complained, he had to circle the livestock, the sheep specifically, 2 miles around this 1 mile long swath of debris. And that's also in the press accounts at that time. And we had numerous accounts of the military describing that because there was so much wreckage and they were out 24/7 for three straight days. And they were spooked by it. They were very nervous about handling this very exotic, very bizarre material.
Sure.
And whenever they had a chance, we heard that they were dumping it down that well shaft.
Oh, man.
700-foot deep well. Wow. So the moment we start actually talking to the technicians that could lower camera equipment with lighting that far down to investigate this, and we go out and we check the well to make sure that it was still safe to work around it, what did the new owners do in the meantime? They had a cement slab placed over it to encase the entire well shaft.
Oh, no.
So it's like you tore down the Heinz house, you capped the well, and now the monument that we placed out there commemorating the event in 2003, overlooking the very site, they want us now to tear it up and move it, get it off of our ranch. Well, it's not on your ranch. It's on BLM, Bureau of Land Management property. Well, we still want it off. And we're giving you so many days to have it. So it's like either this is just all people who want nothing more to do with this case. They want no part of it. And it doesn't even matter that we kept our word all these years. Mm-hmm. We have not made it into a tourist attraction. We have not been leading people out there and showing them that this is what happened here and there. And for the main reason, it's still an active archaeological site. We don't want to risk contamination. We don't want to risk people potentially planting something out at the site. Mm-hmm. So we've always kept it totally secret. Well, that doesn't matter. In other words, they're now threatening that we may never be able to come onto the site again.
Oh, man.
So it's like, okay, I need to sit down with the new owners, but I can't help but wonder who put this bug in their ear.
Right.
Is this all somehow orchestrated? You tear down the main landmark. You cap the well that we were going to finally, you know, investigate. And now you want to prevent us from having future archaeological work at the site. If this were in a movie plot, the audience would be going, this is too predictable.
Yeah.
It's like someone's trying to shut you guys down.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a moment, when we had our first archaeological dig in September of 1989, and we were working to set up the site for future archaeological work.
Mm-hmm.
We had
mm-hmm.
our permit all secured from the Bureau of Land Management. We honored their specific, very strict guidelines. We could not drive onto the site. We had to park our vehicles and then do everything on foot.
Mm-hmm.
We laid out a systematic grid. We mapped out the site. We mounted a theodolite, a survey meter. We, you know, that's the only thing that still remained there at the highest point overlooking the debris field location. And we kept our word. We the place looked like we were never even there mm-hmm. by the time we left. In fact, the ranch foreman at that time, his name was Jeff Wells. And the owner, the co-owner of the ranch at that time was a Donald Bogle. Well, they came out that Sunday afternoon to see us off, say goodbye, and to make sure that we left the place untainted.
Sure.
That, in other words, because it's conservation property, that it would look and appear just as it was before we arrived.
Mm-hmm.
So we drive out, and about a half hour, we drive cross country, and then we drive a gravel road leading us to the first paved road, which is Highway 247, which would lead us up to Corona, about 15 miles from the original nearest town to the very ranch itself, Corona. And it was a Sunday afternoon. We were going to fill up with gas, our four vehicles, and then drive another couple hours up to Albuquerque, spend the night, and everyone fly, you know, to, you know, their homes, their final destinations the next morning out of Albuquerque. So we're in the lead vehicle, three other vehicles behind us. And we pull out on a 247, the paved road, heading in the Corona.
Mm-hmm.
And there off to the side of the road is a Jeep. And a man standing there in fatigues, look like military fatigues.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking on a radio, talking on a two-way. And we think, well, you know, that's kind of curious, but we haven't done anything wrong. So we just continued on. Another few miles, there's another vehicle, another Jeep, another man standing there in military fatigues, talking on a radio. And my scientific director, Dr. Mark Rodiger from the Center for UFO Studies, he just gives me a kind of a wearisome glance from the front seat. And I just smile at him again, like, okay, we haven't done anything wrong. Just
sure.
keep going. Another few miles, the exact same scenario.
Wow.
And then he turns back and he says to me, Don, I think we're in trouble. And I said, well, let's not behave that way. Let's just keep going. So we pull in, and it was a Shell station at that time in Corona. We fill up, and we're just about ready to head out. And another Jeep comes roaring out of nowhere. And this time there are two men in fatigues, jump out, and they confront us. And the one asks, he says, we're not from around here. We're looking for some good areas to go hunting. Can you help us out? And I was the one who responded, sorry, same boat. Talk to the attendant. And I got in the car and I said, let's just get out of here and hope we make it to Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
Strangest thing.
Yeah.
And we arrived in Albuquerque. We spent the night a little nervous as to what still might happen until we got home. We all made it back to the Midwest, Chicago, the Milwaukee, even Michigan area, Aurora, Illinois. Our two archaeologists were from Aurora. And week later, Jeff Wells, the foreman, calls up. And he's laughing. And he says, Don, you're lucky we can vouch for you guys. You're lucky we were out there to see you guys leave. Because the BOM, two agents were just out here. And they're livid. They're mad as can be. Wow. But thank God we could cover for you. We told them it wasn't you. Because when they came out to follow up, to check on the site, someone, multiple vehicles, had torn up the entire site. Spun donuts. Oh. You know, they tore up all the topsoil. Spun out rock and stone all over in every direction. And that was the only site they touched.
That was a setup then.
It was a setup. And it was those guys who were intentionally trying to get us in trouble, discredit us, and make sure we never would be allowed back on the site. Oh. Now, I'm sorry. Again, we have too many witnesses.
Yeah.
Too many people who were out there, too many people, including the BLM agents who photographed and recorded the damage. It happened. And the thought that, well, they just happened to stumble on the very location, which is out in the middle of an 85,000-acre high desert ranch.
Jeez.
It's not like turn left at this cactus or, you know, turn right at that rock.
Sure.
They would not have known at all where the actual site was unless they had it in the official military records as to where this all went down in 1947. And so it was a setup. They were trying to get us in major trouble with the Bureau of Land Management. They failed, and there are ranch hands and ranch foremen since that time who have caught the Air Force out there on numerous occasions since 1989. And then we throw into the mix that we have new owners that we're having to deal with, and they're trying to stop us wholesale. They're telling us you will never be allowed to come out here again. So welcome, as I keep saying, welcome to my world, because the monkey wrenches, the roadblocks keep thrown in our faces all over a damn weather balloon.
Wow. Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah, the official,
it is true. It
official
is true.
Version is a weather balloon. So
over a weather balloon.
They must be really concerned then that there's still items to be found there. They must be.
Or I believe because what we're planning on, the last time we were there, we focused on a depository site about 3/4 of a mile from the actual debris field. I had our geologist, Professor Frank Kimbler, make that determination. Where is everything depositing? The runoff from the rain erosion from the site. And we had an area with about 10 inches of sediment.
Ooh.
That we used metal detectors. We spent 2 days going through. And not so much as a nail or a piece of wire or sheet metal. So now we retrace. We move back again towards the actual location, ground zero. But the one thing we're planning on doing is to cover the area at a much greater extent with subterranean radar.
Oh, nice.
Last time we did that, it was rather limited because they charge so much per hour.
Right.
And there too, I'm sorry, most of the time this is privately funded. Most of the time, you know, we put up much of the lodging, the meals, the transportation back and forth. We bring in volunteers. We typically will pay the archaeologists who are involved. On two occasions, we hired the contract archaeology department from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Mm. And, you know, their budgets can run into the tens of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
And it's one of the reasons since 1989, we've only been back 4 times since. in an official capacity in a scientific search for any artifacts, any remnants. But we haven't given up. And I think it's because we refuse to throw in the towel.
Right.
That we just can't accept that any crash investigation, any retrieval operation would have been that extent, that perfect, yeah. That they would have secured every last shard, every last element. And here we are. I drew up a cartoon years ago for our website, and it's an official from the Pentagon clutching his chest like he's having a heart attack. And he's going, what? They're back in New Mexico. Won't they ever quit? And again, we haven't, we won't. And yet they're the ones, whether with willing accomplices or just people who side with them, continue to try to prevent and stop us, continuing our, what we believe is a nuts and bolts scientific investigation of the crash, including the eyewitnesses who were involved. And obviously we must be winning.
Yeah.
Because they're certainly treating as though we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, the more resistance you encounter, the more you know you're on the right path.
And say if nothing was happening, say after the last 30 years, not a single suggestion of phone surveillance or witness meddling,
sure,
or threats to our witnesses or wiretappings and strange people coming into the museum down in Roswell and the Air Force people who keep nosing around at the crash site itself. I'd obviously would wonder if I was going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And they continue to demonstrate that, as I had a colonel at the Pentagon one time, he called me up and I confirmed he was who he said he was. And he warned me, he said, Don, the closer you get, they're going to make it into a living hell for you.
Wow. Well, we're at break.
They wouldn't have covered it up all these years if there wasn't something to cover up.
Amen. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to break number one. We will be right back after these messages with more of Mr. Don Raymond Schmidt here on the Paranormal Portal. Don't go away. Hey guys, Brent Thomas here of the Paranormal Portal Podcast. We just wanted to take a moment to introduce you to the Paranormal Portal store. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, leggings, stickers, mugs, you name it, you might find it over there. So head on over to teespring.com/stores/paranormal-portal and you too can help fund the Paranormal Portal Podcast. Thank you so much for all that you do and thank you for being a part of our Paranormal Portal family. Welcome back, everybody, to the second half hour of our show tonight. It's obviously we're off to an amazing start. Just a compelling, compelling narrative. And I have no doubt that this is going to be a long journey, but I hope there's a treasure at the end of it for us all. This is a really important event, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, those of you that are familiar with the Roswell crash, it still remains at the forefront of our national consciousness regarding interactions and potential discovery regarding UFOs and extraterrestrials. So our guest tonight, of course, is Mr. Donald Raymond Schmidt, who's joining us and definitely filling in a lot of blanks about this whole journey. But welcome back to the show, Don. And I got to say, it really, when you're describing that chain of events of driving along and seeing all these Jeeps, they weren't even being subtle about it. They weren't even trying to be subtle. They were in your face.
And the one thing I failed to mention there was no hunting season at that time. We're talking the beginning of September. And for them to have, we're looking for some place to do some good hunting. Well, okay. Sorry, that's not why you were there.
Wow.
They were there for the very evidence that they left behind. Hmm. And that, again, was to damage, to violate, to vandalize the very location that we were permitted to conduct our first archaeological effort, and they were trying to disqualify us. Yeah. There is absolutely no reason to doubt it was anyone but those people, those men who were there.
Yeah. It's an absolute orgy of evidence they were trying to pile up. And it's disgusting, you know, that they're willing to do that. I mean, there's just no integrity in it at all. It's just disgusting to me.
But it actually is, par for the course what they did to the very people involved back in 1947.
Yeah.
Extreme measures they went to. I mean, just, and we discussed it the last time I was on, I'm sure, mm-hmm. The physical threats to the, especially the civilians who were involved. The military, for having absolutely no authority over civilians unless martial law is declared. Now, can you imagine if they would have placed as far as a martial law over the city of Roswell, over a weather balloon recovery?
Yeah. It would definitely undermine their narrative for sure.
Precisely. And so they had to resort to the next best attempt at containing all this, and that was physically threatening civilians, physically threatening children. Now, any of your listeners tonight, I'd like to believe that any one of you would draw the line at the point that they would threaten one of your family, that whoever the government official was, whoever would physically threaten to harm one of your family, one of your loved ones, that you wouldn't just bow down and go, okay, fine, if you want to tell me it's just a weather balloon, I accept that. Just don't hurt anybody. Or does it enrage you? Does it infuriate you all the more that you want to get to the bottom of it, that you want to see what would rise to that level, that it would necessitate that extreme treatment of civilians that they are sworn to protect and defend. Mm-hmm. And when I talked about the rancher, Mac Razzle, I mean, just imagine, he reports the find, he reports a debris field of wreckage that no one is able to identify, materials that defy conventional explanation, paper-thin metal-like material that even a bullet wouldn't penetrate, weightless in your hands, 16-pound sledgehammer, wouldn't even scratch. I always, like when I lecture audiences, I always suggest next time you go to a hardware store, you go to a Home Depot, pick up a 16-pound sledgehammer. It would go through your car like tissue paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this stuff, it wouldn't even scratch. And then the memory material, which is what we continue, the search for in our archaeological work, the same nearly indestructible material, but this you could crumble, you could crunch up into a ball, you could crease, you could fold, and every time you place it down, it would unravel. It would return back to its original shape and size right before your eyes without the slightest indication of damage. Mm. Perfect memory. It possessed perfect memory. And so Brazel, he goes in the Roswell, he reports this first to the sheriff. The sheriff can't recognize, he can't identify the material. His deputies have never seen anything like it before. They contact the Roswell Army Airfield. The head of intelligence, Major Marcel, he's never seen anything like it before. The head of counterintelligence, in the event it's something foreign, he has no idea. And then the very base commander, Colonel William Blanchard. And it's important enough that he sends his two lead intelligence officers out into the field to investigate this. Not a couple of enlisted men, a couple of grunts, just to humor the rancher, you know, just go check it out, and, you know, see what it is. No, it's important enough that he sends out two of his lead intelligence officers to check this out firsthand. And then the very next day, while they're at the site, gathering up as much of the material as they can to return with their bounty, and still leaving enough material that it would take another 50 to 60 troops 3 full days to gather up and recover the military abducts Mac Brazel. They have to take him into custody. Mm-hmm. Again, they have no authority. They can't do that.
Right.
But they did. And they don't just hold him for some preliminary questioning. They kept him for 5 full days. They wouldn't even allow him due process to call his own wife, let her know he was safe, he was fine, where he was. His boss, as far as the Foster brothers, J.L. Foster, didn't even allow them, J.B. Foster, call his own boss, why he's not at work, why he's not doing his chores back at the ranch. And they kept him. And they kept him up all hours of the day and night. They withheld food and drink from him. They asked him the same questions over and over and over again.
My God.
And then he started talking about the indignity, what they did to him. He complained to his family and his neighbors afterwards. And that's about all he would admit, because he certainly was not allowed to talk about what he had found, what he had held in his hands, and then even the bodies that he had discovered a few miles away from the debris field. So what he did talk about, what he did describe, was they did a full army physical on him, and they did a strip search and a full body cavity search.
Ugh.
So in other words, they're looking for pieces of a weather balloon, I guess. And, you know, the best thing the skeptics can do is, well, he was lying. Well, we have witnesses that he was gone for 5 days, including other ranchers, including those who saw him in custody in Roswell, 6 of them firsthand, no less, and his own very son, Bill Jr., and as well as his wife, Shirley, who learned about their father's situation, their father-in-law's situation, and immediately went from Albuquerque down to the ranch to take charge, to manage it while their father was still in custody. And then you have also the other son, Paul, who drove all the way over from Western Texas because he was concerned about the horses, the sheep, and the cattle in the open pasture, the open grazing land. They could fend for themselves. But the horses were penned up. They were corralled. They wouldn't be able to feed or water themselves. And if his dad is gone all this time, he was concerned about the horses. And Paul, his son, described to us on two opportunities, he went onto the ranch trying to get to the horses. And the army had commandeered the ranch house.
Oh,
now, mind you, this is 10 miles from the debris field. Well, they still set up their base of operation at their house, at their father's ranch. Now, just imagine, in someone's private home, the army moves in and says, we're setting up shop. This is ours until we leave the scene of the situation. And they kicked him off of the ranch 2 times. They would not even allow him to feed and water the horses. So I'm only talking about a few people here.
Yeah.
And you see the scenario. You see what went down. And I haven't even talked about a flying saucer. I haven't even talked about little bodies, little men involved. I haven't really gotten into the exotic nature of the wreckage. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about just the behavior and what went down just concerning the people who were involved in reporting the crash, and then how they were repaid for doing nothing more than their civic duty,
yeah,
reporting this to the authorities. And then we haven't talked about what they did to the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
As to, does this make sense at all for the recovery of a weather balloon or the same type of balloon, which then evolved into Project Mogul in 1994, when they came out with, when the Air Force had a Pentagon press conference, and then Colonel Richard Weaver announced, well, we lied about the balloon back in 1947, but we have a new theory. We theorize that what may indeed have crashed was a Mogul weather balloon device, a Russian spy balloon, same off-the-shelf materials that even a five-year-old child would have recognized, would have been able to identify in a second. And yet the men, the personnel who were in charge of the atomic bomb, no less, had never seen anything like it in their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, neoprene rubber, reflective foil, wooden sticks, string, and tape. And then Colonel Weaver announces, well, what really confused the men at Roswell 1947 was not the balloon, but the acoustic listening device, the microphone. That was the principal theory of Project Mogul, that when the Soviets detonate their first atomic bomb with this high-altitude stationary weather balloon, that it would be up there, and with its specific ballast design and arrangement and its array of kites, that it would then pick up the shockwave in the upper atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Well, the project failed miserably. It didn't work. But to suggest in 1994 that what confused, you know, those, the most elite unit within the United States military in 1947 was a microphone. That they saw that and they immediately went, oh my God, we're being invaded. Must be from outer space.
Yeah.
And then to this day, Brent, whether it's still would be the skeptics or even the willing accomplices in the press, we continue to hear the constant, you know, bromides about Mogul being responsible for the entire misidentification of Roswell. But the fact that there are absolutely no witnesses to that claim, mm-hmm, to this very day, defeats that argument before it even, you know, gets off the ground, so to speak. Excuse the pun.
Sure.
But they have absolutely zero witnesses. All they have is, we're the government. We're only here to help you, ladies and gentlemen. And case closed.
Hmm.
Well, we hear that every day, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a common
thing. We're only the government. Trust us. Believe us.
Yeah, well, if only. You know, I just wonder what is the end game to the denial of it? Is it just to hoard the information of the craft? Do you think that if they did say, okay, guys, we're going to let it out, there was a crash, it was a UFO, we got that, but we just have to keep it. I mean, wouldn't it be okay just to say it was real and they have to, you know, keep it secret while they study it?
Well, they could acknowledge that they are still studying. They're okay. Still attempting, making efforts to reverse engineer the technology. But here we are. Our cars and other devices are hardly made of memory material.
Mm-hmm.
We're still, you know, I mean, albeit we're getting into electric propulsion, but we've had that now for many decades. It's just that now it's finally becoming more practical. Mm-hmm. But we're still driving gasoline and diesel engines. We're still flying jets, and we're still launching solid and liquid fuel rockets.
Yeah.
We really haven't advanced that much in our our propulsion technology.
Right.
In the last 50, even 75 years.
Yes.
And as I emphasized it the last time we talked, Brent, I still maintain it's a cover up of ignorance. I find it very arrogant on the part of, you know, we human beings that we think we can get into the pilot seat like Will Smith in Independence Day and just fly that alien spacecraft like it's one of our own.
Right.
You know, just to talk about the ultimate arrogance on our part.
Sure.
And I maintain it's still a cover up of ignorance. We cannot bridge that technology. It's that advanced. How do we just automatically, you know, step into that level of information,
sure,
that level of achievement, accomplishment, no different than if we were to teleport a TV back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
They'd be able to figure it out. Well, we know that wouldn't be the case.
Sure.
And so I still maintain that we don't know from where, from who, and from why. So there is nothing to disclose. I mean, they can acknowledge we're not alone. We have the physical hardware. Mm-hmm. We have the physical proof. But who is going to make that announcement,
right,
and get reelected? Who's going to make that announcement and still have the faith and the trust of the peoples of the world, knowing that there's something out there that is able to fly with total impunity within our airspace, our own respective air sovereignty, and there's nothing we can do about it?
Do you think then that in light of like the Tic Tac craft and the Navy disclosure, that moves us closer to possibly getting that kind of acknowledgement, though? Because, I mean, it's out there now, and we know that there's even, I don't know if it's an official disclosure so much as it sounds like it was more accidental that it was released.
Yes and no, because okay, someone still had to authorize these pilots and other,
yes,
Navy personnel actually speaking out. In the past, we never would have heard from any of these, you know, military officers.
Right.
Roswell is a principal example. The witnesses who were the least willing to speak out were the officers with their pensions, with their very careers, sure, at stake. JNAP 146, which is Joint Army Navy Air Force procedure, is still on the books. And it reads, any disclosure of classified UFO information outside of respective ranks is forfeiture of all pension and benefits, $10,000 fine, and or 10 years imprisonment.
Wow.
And so is it any wonder that no one has ever talked before?
Right.
So someone had to relax those restrictions. And the fact that it wasn't just a one-time, you know, just slipping and saying the wrong thing to the wrong people. No, they have repeatedly stepped out,
yeah,
and described what they witnessed, that these objects, that the object that they witnessed defied the laws of physics, that it was beyond our technology, well beyond their, you know, that any human being inside that craft would have been smashed to bits.
Yeah.
You know, just the extreme rates of acceleration and the extreme levels of deacceleration, nothing that we could sustain physically, humanly, as we know. And so I personally would like to believe the Air Force were to come out tomorrow and say, ladies and gentlemen, we know we've been deceiving the world. We've been lying for 72 years about this, but trust us now. We're going to tell you what's actually going on, right, and why we had to lie to you all this time. Still wouldn't believe it, because that's all they've done for 72 years. They keep having press conferences. They keep coming out with new stories, new explanations. They keep stalling for time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Navy has never done that. The Army has never done that. I'd like to believe, and I had one of the pilots who was involved, who still remains anonymous. And he told me that the Navy has been fed up with the Air Force for years.
Oh.
Speaking out for them, representing them. And one has to understand that the different branches of the military, they compete with one another. The pilots in the Air Force compete with the pilots in the Navy. And I can tell you personally, the best pilots in the world are Navy, not the Air Force, they're Navy. And it's not because I have worked and I know a lot of these guys. It's that they have global surveillance, global coverage. The Air Force are restricted to sovereign airspace. That limits them. You know, if you remember during the Reagan administration, and we had the raid on Tripoli in Libya, and France did not allow us to fly over mainland France for that attack. So they had to circle around and they had to refuel. It caused them to have to, you know, a greater risk to the mission. But nonetheless, it was a demonstration of how we have to get permission, the Air Force at least, to cover respective as far as airspace. Another example was during Desert Storm. And I'll never forget then the late General Norman Schwarzkopf. And he was complaining at one of the press conferences days after that first raid, that first attack on Baghdad. And that very first evening, the United States Air Force declared air supremacy over Iraq. And Schwarzkopf was complaining that the Army wasn't being informed by the Air Force, if that was even true, not knowing if it was then safe for the Army to proceed deeper into Iraq. The Navy was not on the same page as the Air Force, not knowing what the Army, what the ground troops were doing, and if they were to continue launching their cruise missiles into Baghdad. So to me, it just clearly demonstrated that even with, you know, in contemporary times, they're not working together. They're not on the same page. They're competing with one another still. Post-World War II. So this idea that, well, if the Air Force says there are no UFOs, then it's good enough for the Navy. Well, when the Air Force declassified their Project Blue Book files, the most famous of their three UFO investigations in 1977. And we even have, you know, the new popular TV series on the History Channel.
Sure.
Project Blue Book, which is about 90% fiction. Nonetheless, when Blue Book was declassified, there were a few of us that were asking the obvious question, where were all the Navy cases?
Yeah.
Where were all the Army cases?
It's
almost all Air Force.
Sure it is. You're right.
Certainly, the Navy had their own studies, their own investigations. Likewise, the Army did. Back in 1947, Roswell was an Army incident. But it was no Air Force.
Yeah.
This was an Army incident. So here, the Air Force publicly represented an official investigation into the phenomenon when the Navy and the Army, the Marine Corps, even Air National Guard, they all chose to conduct their own in private, in secrecy.
Gotcha.
And so another reason I would love to believe that the Air Force, realizing that they want this to come out. The new order, who has seen that the old order has taken this with them in many respects, this is the first generation that is saying, we are going to slowly trickle out the information.
Shooting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.